co-founder and program director of Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries, based in Oakview, California. Ted Myers co-created this organization in 1998 to be an ecumenical experiment in discipleship and mutual aid. Its goal is to foster peace and justice, achieved without violence. Ted has done extensive biblical study, particularly on the Gospel of Mark, and he has taught in seminaries and schools of theology in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom, and Word and Life. He is a leader of retreats and an active participant in numerous conferences, and he's a prolific author, and many of his books are back there on the table for you to see, and if you wish to buy, the prices are listed there. His website is up on the board there, so if you'd like to go to that website also. We are blessed to have him with us today as we continue our study of Marcus Bourque's book, The Heart of Christianity. Let us stand and give Chad our blessing with the prayer written on the board.
May God bless all of you. May God's face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May God look upon you kindly and give you peace.
And welcome.
Well, good morning, everybody. Can everybody hear? All right. I understand this is the 30th anniversary this year of Word and Life. Is that right?
This year.
30 years. I think that's really to be commended. And I want to add my congratulations to you. This is, as I'm sure you know, not an ordinary thing for folk to do in the American church. And therefore... Okay, sure. To get together to have serious conversation and reflection and to stay at it to long enough to get into significant breadth and depth in terms of the content of faith. So I do commend you. How many of you have been part of Word and Life for more than 5 years? So a number of you. And it's been a group about this size that's been rolling along from year to year, and I just think it's very, very wonderful. I think I was here either 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember. Any of you remember when I was here last time we talked about money?
Yeah.
Don't worry, we won't talk about money. The whole economy's gone to hell anyway. You weren't listening. We'll talk about something far more frightening than money. We'll talk about the theme of this book by Marcus Bourque. Now, Marcus, you've been into this for a number of weeks now. You've got a great lineup of folk who come to work with you through this book. Straw poll, are you enjoying the Bourque book?
Yes.
It's a pretty easy read. In some ways, maybe pitched a little light for a serious study group like this, but nevertheless raises some very, very good issues. Bourque, as you know, is a New Testament scholar who's really devoted the last 10 years or so to trying to popularize a lot of the scholarship around the Jesus story, and then I think largely out of motivation of his wife, who is a spiritual director, trying to figure out how to popularize the whole story of faith, and this is one in at least a half a dozen books that he's come out with in the last number of years trying to do that. I'm delighted that you invited, I'm delighted for three reasons. One is to be with a serious study group, which is always a privilege. Secondly, I'm delighted to be with a group that I don't have to get on a plane to be with. and thirdly, I'm happy to be asked to talk with you about the Born Again chapter. I would have figured I would have gotten the next chapter in the book, which is all about the kingdom of God and the heart of justice, because that's the trail I'm usually on around the churches, is talking to folk about peace and justice. So it's nice for me to let somebody else do that and to look at what is really the more personal side of faith. But as Ward points out right at the beginning of his chapter, very clearly, all of this material is profoundly personal and profoundly political. So much so that I find it almost impossible to pull the two apart. Now, Borg, have any of you ever met Marcus Borg or heard him live? A few of you have. Very, very gentle preacher, good teacher. His mission really is largely aimed at your demographic, because he comes from your demographic, although probably more aimed at the liberal Protestant side. I assume that most of you are coming out of a Roman Catholic background. Any non-Catholics in the group? Just a few, the faithful remnant. nevertheless, it is folk who have, in many cases, been raised in the church, maybe journeyed away from the church, journeyed back to the church, have a creative and somewhat conflictive relationship with the tradition, asking a lot of questions. As you put it in your flyer, you're looking for a mature faith. That's something Marcus Borg is very interested in. He's talking to people who have been alienated or confused by two aspects of our churches, both Catholic and Protestant. On one hand, you have sort of an authoritarian drift in American religion. And that is as true of some of the new conservatism coming into the Catholic Church. You know, we've got to go to the old rites, we've got to give the priests more authority, Vatican II out the window. That sort of authoritarianism, sort of clericalism, on one hand. On the other hand, you've got sort of the Protestant fundamentalist authoritarianism, which isn't so much clericalism as it is biblicism. Those are the people who run around, you know, bopping you over the head with their Bible. And intimidating you as to whether or not you've been born again. You know, the Catholics are running for the exits. What does that mean? What does this mean? And so there's a whole bunch of folk who have been either confused or alienated by authoritarianism in the church, whether it's of the Protestant or the Catholic variety, or both. On the other hand, the other equally confusing and alienating trend in the church is what I would call not authoritarianism, but diffidence, ambivalence. We go to church, doesn't much happen. Not much is required, not much is expected. You go to church, you get in, you get out, nobody gets hurt, nobody gets famous, nobody gets saved. And so you sort of take it or leave it. And that's the sort of, you know, denominationalism or cultural Catholicism that frankly is also equally confusing to mature faith, because mature faith has to be about something as opposed to about nothing. Would you agree? And so would you agree that sort of we're constantly wrestling for mature faith between the specters of American religion of authoritarianism on one hand and ambivalence on the other? And that's, I think, what we're trying to do here. That's what I think Borg is trying to be about. And I like the fact that he says, well, the reason I want to focus on the image of being born again is because we have conceded that to the authoritarian church. Mm-hmm. And why are we conceding some of our best and most powerful and most animating images and symbols to the authoritarians? Let's try to take back some of these symbols. I think that's a very important project that lies right at the heart of a lot of the work that we do in Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries, and so that's what I want to spend a little bit of this first hour working together as a group around rehabilitating some of these images. Did you find after reading the chapter, and I know all of you do read the chapter, so we don't have to worry about whether you've done your homework or not, because you're not part of the ambivalent wing of the church, the committed wing of the church. Did you find that to be a friendlier notion after you read this chapter, the idea of being born again? Did you feel actually, hey, this is great to own this again, to reclaim this image. A lot of times in the culture wars, things get so polarized, and so if they're saying that, then I can't use that language at all. And I think that's one of the great tragedies of the culture wars, particularly as they impact our churches. So what I want to do is work a little bit as a group for about 20 minutes on this image and related images of conversion, transformation. And then what I want to do is take a little field trip into a different demographic. I want to introduce you all to the way these things get talked about by people under 40. And I'm going to show you a little clip from a film that came out 6-8 years ago that was a very important film, in my opinion, one of the most profoundly theological films that's come out in decades. But it wasn't aimed at you, and probably you didn't see it. How many of you saw the film The Matrix? Yeah, see, wasn't aimed at your demographic, but a few of you got into the wrong theater and, you know, wow, what's this? It's a fabulous film, but it's all about computers and virtual realities and technology and the kind of stuff that, I'm 53, so I'm just on the bubble there. I don't understand half this stuff. But I was really struck by that. And particularly, I'm going to show you about a 6-7 minute segment, which I think is one of the most amazing cinematic expressions of the biblical notion of what it means to be born again. And that'll take us to the break. Then we'll all chill out with some coffee and cupcakes, and then we'll come back. And what I want to do is spend the last 45 minutes reflecting with you on the central image and ritual that comes more out of the heart of your tradition. Not so much the psychological, emotional, spiritual, existential crisis of being born again in the sort of Protestant revival tradition, but rather the classic Catholic notion of what it means to transfer from death to life, namely the ritual of baptism. And so I want to spend the second 45 minutes looking at the ritual of baptism, particularly as it's expressed in the New Testament, because I think that's probably bedrock for the metaphor for most of you all, as it should be. It's a very powerful image. So that's a little map of what we're going to do. Does that sound like that's worth spending the morning here on this nice hot Santa Barbara day?
Yes.
The working hypothesis for all of this work, and I think this is something that Marcus Borg would agree with, he sort of sniffs around it in this chapter, is the most important theological proposition that I know of. And it's very simple. All talk about God is metaphorical. That's it. That's all you really need to do to know. You don't need to go to seminary. As long as you understand, all talk about God is metaphorical. Almost by definition, if in fact God is transcendent of our reality, then any way in which we might try to name or image or narrate or symbolize God is necessarily going to have to say sort of like this, sort of like that. To say God is this definitively is idolatry, at least in the biblical tradition. That's what the first commandment really means, to have no God other than Yahweh and to make no images, means you got to understand that all of our attempts to figure out who God is, what God is, where God is, it's all metaphorical. That does not mean it's not real or substantive. It just means we have to hold on somewhat lightly to our metaphors, understanding that as good as this metaphor may be, there are other metaphors that are going to shed other light. Does that make sense? And that's a very rich and beautiful way in which the church talks about God. If that is true about God, then it would stand to reason that all genuine discourse about spiritual experience of God is also metaphor. In other words, we're searching for ways to talk about something that cannot be captured or locked down or put into a neat box. Now, that makes the authoritarian side of the church very uncomfortable. But it's very important, having said that, to say that these metaphors aren't willy-nilly or completely ad hoc. These metaphors have depth, they have profound meaning, they are experientially based, and they have demands that go along with them. So it's not let's just all sit around and image God however we want. It's that the church in its history has come upon metaphors that have great grounding. They link us both to experience but also to responsibilities of how we should act in the world. And that makes the ambivalent side of the church nervous. So here we are camped out in the middle trying to build a bridge on our backs. Well, what are some of the symbols that come up in the born-again scenario that Borg talks about in this chapter? He notices that there's a number of sort of double meanings as he talks about this image. What are some of them?
Water.
Okay. Water and spirit. You have to be born by water, you have to be born by spirit. So there's already we're into what does it mean to be born by water? What does it mean to be born by spirit? So that's two very rich circles of meaning. What else?
Death and resurrection.
Death and resurrection. We're going to talk a lot about that in the second hour.
Light and darkness.
Yeah, light and darkness are there. Let's think. See, that's getting now towards the abstract. Mm-hmm. The important thing about metaphors is that they have to sort of be referential to something concrete for them to really work their power. But, you know, we sort of know what light and darkness is, more or less, and we start from there. When we get into abstract terminology, it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. One of the dualisms that's implied here is not just water and spirit, but flesh and spirit, mm-hmm. Born of the flesh, born of the spirit. This is also, as Borg rightly says, in this little, placard text of being born again, which are held up at football games kind of thing, are some very deep archetypes that you find everywhere in the New Testament. He's right about that, so it's a great place to camp out for a minute. Now, when we get into flesh and spirit, it's pretty confusing, because we're not entirely sure what we mean by spirit, although we think we recognize it when we see it or feel it. But we're really confused about what we mean by flesh. Oh yeah, we understand the meat part of flesh. But flesh, would that, don't live according to the flesh, how does that sit with you in your tradition? Is that positive connotation, or sound like a whole lot of prohibitions you have to wrestle with?
Well, we've got that adjective carnal, and it's got a bad ring to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in Latin, carne. Mm-hmm. It's the meat. It's the flesh. What has been the correlation that the church has tended to make? Flesh equals sex. Yeah, let's cut to the chase here. Thank you. Didn't need to spend a whole lot of time on that. One of the greatest, most destructive double messages we get in churchly traditions is the message we get about sex. Namely, sex is bad, save it for someone you love. Mm-hmm. sure we're half crazy. And the flesh conjures all that up because there have been trajectories in the church that have taken that in. The flesh, as it's used in John or in Paul in the New Testament, has nothing really to do with sex. It is a metaphor. And it's a metaphor that's trying to talk about something that we'll see re-metaphorized in this film in a few minutes. It's the way we've been socialized to think by the dominant culture. It's the majority opinion. It's what Walter Wink calls the domination system. It's how the principalities and powers, these are all metaphors, have trained us to think. And we learn it in school, and we learn it on the playground, and we learn it at home, and we learn it in church, and we learn it at the football game, and we learn it in all the dominant institutions. And so, for example, when we are socialized to believe in 1,000 different little ways that if someone hits you, you should what? You should hit him back. Or get somebody else to hit him back. Who's bigger? The idea that justice is retributive would be one of these dominant ideas. Don't you think? If you don't think so, if you want to test it out next cocktail party you're at, strike up a conversation about the death penalty or about the Iraq war and just see how it goes. From Paul's point of view, the flesh, the word in Greek is sarx. The flesh is the sum total of the ideas and the myths and the assumptions about life that we get from the dominant culture, such as justice is retributive. And so when you think according to the flesh, you think, yeah, justice is retributive because our president told us it is. We must destroy those who hate us. Now, of course, the other non-conventional wisdom that the New Testament tries to work with is that there is a notion of justice that is restorative, that understands crime or violation as something that's a sickness and that needs to be healed, and that the enemy or the adversary is part of that solution. That for the victim to find satisfaction, it has to include the offender. That you can't ever solve the problem by destroying the enemy. So the counterintuitive, the non-conventional wisdom is love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Hasn't really been part of the mainstream thinking of our churches. Because our churches are socialized according to the flesh. Now, if that's true today, it's true 2,000 years ago. Jesus, Paul, John were all talking to a religious tradition that had largely accommodated itself to the conventional wisdom and so thought according to the flesh. You see how this doesn't have anything to do with sex? Mm-hmm. Now, there are ways in which it's relevant in terms of how we practice sexuality. But the flesh isn't about sex bad. The flesh is about how we can break out of the dominant way that we think about things to begin to see God's alternative, which frankly isn't being beamed at us 24/7 on the 6 o'clock news and through the National Security Council, and for that matter, in most of our catechisms in church. So when John talks about being born again, he's really referring to this idea that, you know, we're all socialized into this groupthink. And in order for us to start to get at what this tradition of God that Jesus is bearing is about, we're going to have to be born not of the flesh, but of the Spirit. We're going to have an alternative way of understanding the world. Is this making sense so far?
Yes.
That would be an example of how some of these metaphors work. Now, a metaphor, remember, is experientially based. The thing about being born is that we've all had that experience. Now, Borg, in the second half of this chapter, spends a lot of time sort of doing some depth psychology work about, you know, early childhood and how we sort of lose the plot as we grow up and mature, and he correlates that to a reading of The Fall. And that's, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it, and a very venerable way in which that has been understood. Jews, for example, largely understand the Garden of Eden story as a fall into maturity, as a fall away from childlike innocence, something that had to happen. Well, it may or may not have had to happen. It did happen. It does happen with all of us. The question is, how do we fix it? How do we break free of the bondage to slavery? More metaphors. And John's notion, one of them, is that we must be reborn. Now, what I would like to do is I'm going to put three chairs up here. And I think it's always pretty treacherous to talk about birthing as a man. So I know that there are at least three women out there who have had the experience of giving birth. And what I'd like to invite you to do is just have three of you come up and just give us a minute about when you think of giving birth, what comes up. It might be a feeling, it might be a body memory, might be a spiritual revelation that happened. Just to get this out of the abstract, don't be shy. I'm going to share the mic with you. Come on up. Here's one. The dam is breaking. Here's two. Jeannie, Harriet, how about one more?
Come on.
Great. Give me about a minute of just sort of what comes up for you. I'm not talking philosophical abstract. What comes up in your body? What comes up in your memory? What stands out as you look back on the experience of giving birth?
God. I nearly killed my girl because I had this amazing experience when my children were born. The peak of the pain being ecstatic. So I said to him, no, don't take things. Just go through the ecstasy of it. And some of them still look at me and say, don't ever tell anybody that. But I had really, through the pain, and more than once, I had this feeling at the height of pain where I went into another space and experienced ecstatic. And I, from that moment, I knew that my children were divine beings.
Thank you.
But still with me.
Let's not forget that.
I've heard you say that before, and thank you. That always touches my heart. Amazement, I think, was the first word that came to my mind beyond. Well, the first thing would be the pain, but I think that whole amazement and gift of being co-creators with God, that still amazes me today when somebody is pregnant, and I just had a great-granddaughter, God, I'm going to tear up at this, because it just amazes me to think that we, as human beings, can do this and bring life. Of course, we do it in many ways, but in childbirth, I think that's just beautiful.
They said it all. But I had a funny experience with my son, is that everything stopped. And I think I was dreading it. And they had a major time getting going. And I think I was a little bit not a participating, willingly participating in it, but I think it happens whether we like it or not. So I was definitely happier afterwards.
Any Any body memories you want to share?
During or? Well, once it got going, it was
fatigue.
Well, yeah, but I had an unpleasant experience. They surprised me. It was 20 City College students standing there waiting to watch me, and they never warned me, and that's when everything stopped. And then the doctor lifted his arms up, and the guy had muscles like this, and he just literally pulled them up. So I can't say that it was easy, so... But as soon as my son was out, I remember then I wasn't even aware of anybody being there anymore.
Anything else from the two of you?
There is that groaning and pushing.
Can you hear me? There is, the whole experience of giving birth, of releasing, but also that, what is the scripture quote? The groaning and... Mm-hmm. It won't come to me, but anyway, that constant. Once it gets going, there's no turning back. You've got it.
Release. Even the Apostle Paul, who didn't know anything about giving birth, uses the metaphor of labor. As a metaphor for the entire creation. The entire creation, he said, is groaning in labor, waiting for the children of God to stop thinking according to the flesh and start getting with the program of the Spirit. Romans 8. A powerful metaphor. Let's give a little hand to our panel. Now, I want to reflect a little bit on this text that we've just put. I was just sort of writing down some of the words that were coming up. We are abstract people. We're in our heads a lot as a culture, so we tend to give abstract. In an embodied culture, you'd talk about stuff like blood and... screams and fluids, water, amniotic fluid. It'd be a little bit more concrete, which is what you're getting in the New Testament most of the time when they talk about blood and water as symbols. They're anchoring that in the concrete experience of, for example, giving birth. Now, when we look at this list of things, we could be looking at childbirth, but what else could we be looking at? Yeah. We could be looking at dying.
Life.
A little too abstract. Moments.
Moments of resurrection.
Mystical experiences. Absolutely. Moments of conversion. Moments of transformation, of passage from death to life. Moments of enlightenment, right? So we're talking about the birthing process. We're talking about the dying process. Many of you have done hospice. This is all very familiar to you. And we're talking about moments of what we can call generally conversion. In other words, and we're also talking about, what's the last really traumatic thing that happened in Santa Barbara, maybe the fires. If you were close to the fires, all this stuff, seeing the smoke in the sky and hearing the sirens and maybe helping people evacuate. It's all like you're on the edge, right? All of this stuff, fatigue, pain, amazement. These are all what psychologists and sociologists call liminal moments. That is, there are moments in which you're living on a threshold, right? A threshold limb is literally the threshold on a door. So you're not quite inside, you're not quite outside, you're in the transition. And in those moments, which usually are the peak experiences of life, you have all of this stuff going on. We sort of break out of the normal routine, we're alive. the chair of our board is a family therapist, and he talks about going up to the altar when he was 20 at a Nazarene church, one of these little fundamentalist churches. And it's an altar call, right? When you go up to be born again, to take Jesus as your Savior. And he was up there and he was kneeling, and two elders from the church on either side of him, on either arm. And one of them is saying into his ear, "Just hold on, brother, just hold on." And the other one is saying, "Just let go, brother, just let go." Perfect. Right? It's perfect. It's all about pushing and releasing. Right? All at the same time. It's about ecstasy and it's about pain. The two words, if you remember the Mark's empty tomb story, you remember that the women go and they see that the tomb is empty. And you remember that they're running from the tomb. And Mark 16:7 tells us, and they ran from the tomb and they were filled with, in Greek, thromos kai ecstasis. Trauma and ecstasy all at once. These liminal moments in which we sort of break through, the Celts call it getting to a thin place where the ecstasy of heaven breaks in on the trauma of earth and you sort of feel the nearness of the Spirit. Whenever we have liminal places, thin places in our life, that is what the whole notion of conversion, transformation, enlightenment, mystical experience is all about. It's about leaving behind the sort of monochromatic world of conformity of the Sarks and being in the realm of the Spirit where, and I want to focus on these two notions here because all of the New Testament metaphors are metaphors that invoke trauma and ecstasy. To go down into the water like death is both ecstatic and traumatic. To give birth is traumatic and ecstatic. Move from blindness to sight, there's another metaphor, is full of both trauma and ecstasy. To see for the first time is not just ecstatic, it's traumatic. It hurts your eyes. We're going to see that metaphorized in the film. All of this is to say that all talk about genuine spiritual experience is metaphor, but these metaphors are extremely powerful and extremely important. And one of the things we do well to do in our spiritual life and in our discipleship is to reflect on these metaphors and to figure out, now, what do I need to do to prepare myself for moments of trauma and ecstasy? Moving from blindness to sight is one of the big metaphors, particularly in the Gospel of Mark. Move from death to life, from blindness to sight, from deafness to hearing, from not walking to walking. These are all metaphors trying to explain, very somatic metaphors, by the way, in your body metaphors, trying to name the experience of leaving the ordinary. And two things happen when we're in this liminal space. The traumatic part of it is that we see the world the way it actually really is, as opposed to all the delusions and denial that we normally live with. So part of the vision of transformation is to be able to strip away all the illusions. So for example, part of what that means is the delusion that everything's pretty much okay because I live in a middle class society. Everything's not okay, friends. Not on this planet. Not in our society, not even in Santa Barbara. But there are 100 ways that we convince ourselves that it's really okay. Okay enough that I don't actually have to go out of my way to do anything about it. And we all live like that all the time. The liminal experience suddenly exposes that lie. So not only are we talking about dying, birthing, or mystical experience, it might be just taking a trip on an exposure tour to Nogales, Mexico, and encountering poverty for the first time. That's also a liminal experience. You're out of your safety zone. You encounter the actual face of the poor, and suddenly poverty becomes real. That's the traumatic side of the liminal experience of conversion. Is this making any sense? We see the world the way it really is in its pain and its duplicity and its degeneration. This was really brought home to me by Manuel Hernandez, who's a Catholic worker friend who came up from Mexico. He'd lived in rural Mexico his whole life, came up across the border as an undocumented person, ended up at the Catholic worker house in Los Angeles. Catholic worker house in Los Angeles is between three freeways, right in Boyle Heights in East LA. It's loud all the time. And when he first came to live in that house, he said he felt deafened all the time because he'd never heard, he had scarcely heard a internal combustion engine, much less hundreds of thousands of them whirring by, so it's a wall of sound. And he said for the first 6 months, he couldn't hear, he was disoriented. And then he said, one day I realized I don't hear it anymore. Right? Because he didn't become assimilated, acculturated, acclimated to it. Right? So he didn't see the trauma of that anymore. He wasn't sick by hearing that. He was actually healthy because he heard that sound. The sickness is when you no longer hear it. Yes?
The word disillusionment carries a negative connotation, but it can also be very positive.
It sure can.
What leads to change.
I actually have a whole chapter on that in one of the books back there, talking about disillusionment as one of the fundamental spiritual disciplines of discipleship, to begin to strip away the illusions. Now, if that's the traumatic side, to see the world as it really is, the ecstatic side is to see the world the way God really wants it to be, in all of its beauty and all of its juiciness and all of its fabulous kaleidoscopic richness and color, which also gets lost in the world of the Sarks. We no longer see the bright colors. We drive by. I mean, how many times you've been driving down 101, you look over and say, oh yeah, there are the Channel Islands. Right? And in a lot of the Eastern traditions, enlightenment is, whoa, has anybody seen those islands out there? It's that moment of, those are fabulous. And it's like, there's an image in another film called Wings of Desire, in which angels start the day all lined up on the beach watching the sunrise. Why? Because it's the best show in town. But how many times is the sun setting right over Point Conception and we're sort of looking at it saying, oh, I got to get somewhere. We're missing the ecstasy that's woven into creation. So the way I would shorthand this consciousness is we don't know how bad it is, the traumatic. We really don't. We have no idea how far down the road of ozone destruction we are. We have no idea what we're doing to the aquifer. We have no idea what we're doing to our own gene pool. We have no idea how bad it is. Why? Because we don't know how good it is. Because we've lost the ecstatic vision, we've lost our ability to handle the trauma. And vice versa. We don't know how good it is, because we don't know how bad it is. We have acclimated to the roar of those three freeways, and we actually think that's how life is. Is this making any sense? So all of this is, as you can see at once, both profoundly personal and profoundly political. That when a human being awakens to the ecstasy and to the trauma, when a person is truly born again, I'm not talking about a ritual where you go to the front of the church, get your Bible, get your name on a list, and back you go, good luck, which is frankly what a lot of the altar call stuff is in church. Just as in Catholic church, you go to church, you get your little wafer, you go home, right? I'm talking about when a human being awakens, not just once, but over and over again, to the true ecstasy and the true trauma. That is a dangerous human being. Because that human being is going to be tuned into the beauty in a way that's going to make you think they're a little goofy. Why? Because they're just looking at the sunset. And they can't be bothered to get to that meeting. Because have you seen the sunset over Point Conception? And we're like, there's some little goofy going on there, a little religious experiment. Yeah. You know, that person is dangerous because they're moved by what is truly ecstatic and strangely unmoved by the normal. And that person is dangerous because they've seen the trauma and they're going to do something about it. That's just a little spiritual static. Now, what I'm going to try to underline, as I think Borg is doing this chapter, underline how serious it is what we're talking about. These metaphors are not just, you know, willy-nilly God talk. They're profoundly consequential metaphors about dying and rising and water and spirit and blood and flesh. This is all about the transformation of everything personal and political. And we have, in our churches, largely lost that. Both in authoritarian and in ambivalent churches. We've lost that. And mature faith is trying to figure out how do we actually bring that from the margins of religious experience to the center of our experience. Now, as the churches are sort of fiddling while Rome burns, frankly, afraid of a lot of this. What happens is these same impulses start coming up in the culture. And what I'm going to show you here just before the break is just 5 or 6 minutes of this film, The Matrix, which is just a profound cinematic attempt to, with as far as I know, no theological backgrounding. I actually did research when I saw this film, and who are these guys who wrote this? And a couple of independent filmmakers became a big sort of cultural phenomenon. And let's go ahead and turn the lights out. this will seem really weird to you, and it's dark. It's gothic. But it's set in a sort of a post-Holocaust world in which human beings, see if you can wrap your mind around this. These are people who are trying to take seriously the trauma of post-modernity. The premise of the film is that human beings have been colonized by machines. In particular, colonized by computers. Computers run the world. Human beings are simply used as batteries to fuel the machines because it's post-peak oil, it's post-Holocaust, there's no oil. So how are you going to get energy to run the machines? You use human beings, the organic material, as batteries. So in fact, human beings are all in pods in these giant warehouses, plugged in, giving energy to what's called the Matrix. And the Matrix is this world run by computers. But why would human beings stand for that? Being sucked, have their lives sucked away. Because the computers, in turn, have plugged the human beings into a virtual reality which makes them think they're living a normal life. So this little segment is, there's this guerrilla group of human beings who have unplugged themselves from the Matrix and who are now trying to go and rescue other human beings. But they have to convince the human beings that the virtual reality they're living isn't real. Sound like, yeah? And here's the name of the human being who's begun to have doubts about whether this reality is really real, but he doesn't know who these people are who are trying to lead him into breaking with the Matrix. So he's still sort of in the flesh, but he sort of sees the spirit. And this is an encounter between Neo, the new human being, and Morpheus, the god of dreams, who is the figure who's trying to invite him to liberation. I hope this works. I'm going to hold that. It's pretty dark, I know. He's coming down a dark hallway. This is it.
give you one piece of advice. Be honest. He knows more than you can imagine.
At last. Welcome here. As you no doubt have guessed, I am Morpheus.
It's an honor to meet you.
No. The honor is mine. Please, come. Sit. Imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole.
You can say that.
I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind. Driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. What truth? That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Experience. He goes down and he awakens to realize he's in one of these pods and there are all these things plugged into him, and he has this traumatic vision of, wow, this is the way it really is. And then the Pharaoh figures come and rescue him, and he starts his journey toward the real truth of the way of life. Isn't that astonishing discourse to come from secular film? Mm-hmm. It's exactly what we're talking about. It's some of the best gospel that I've seen in popular culture. If we are not talking about this and struggling with this in our churches, in our faith communities, it's going to pop up somewhere else. And of course, that's good news, because it's it's the splinter in my mind. My favorite line from this is, what is the flesh? It's the world pulled over your eyes. It's a play on the notion of pulling the wool over somebody's eyes. The world pulled over our eyes. We think that our normal daily life is the way it really is. But what we're really missing is the depth of the trauma and the depth of the ecstasy. That is, I believe, some of what the ancient writer of the Gospel of John is trying to get at when he draws on the metaphor to Nicodemus, who, like Neo, has a splinter in his mind. He knows something's wrong. And he comes to Jesus, and Jesus holds out the pills and says, you have to be born again. You have to take the red pill. To see how far down this rabbit hole this thing goes. How much trauma, how much ecstasy. It's fabulous. Let's take a break. We'll come back and debrief this a little bit, but I don't want to cut into the cupcake time.